happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage. Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time. Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough. And last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Hey, gang, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the editor of the Fretboard Journal magazine. As always, that's John Rauhaus playing in the background. As I say almost every week, if you like what we are up to, if you like podcasts such as this one and the other podcasts that we produce, the Truth About Vintage Amps podcast or Luthier on Luthier, the best way to support all of these endeavors, including all the stuff we do online, is by subscribing to the Fretboard Journal magazine. Right now, we are offering digital subscriptions to the Fretboard Journal for just $30. That's for the four next issues that we are going to put out, along with the two most recent issues. So six issues for $30, $5 a piece, basically. Or if you want to go all out, of course, you can subscribe to the print edition of the Fretboard Journal. That is what we are known for. It is what I've spent the last 15 years of my life doing, and it is where you will find all sorts of interviews like the ones we are talking about today. So on the podcast today, I rarely ever talk to fellow podcasters. It's a little too meta. I know there are a lot of podcasts out there, but there was one that was so cool that it was produced by our friends over at the Bluegrass Situation that I wanted to talk to its host. And that host is today's guest, Tom Power. Tom is probably not a household name if you live in America, but if you live up in Canada, he probably is. He is the host of Q on CBC Radio. He is a well-known broadcaster and radio personality. He's all over the place, all sorts of projects. We get into his history a little bit on this podcast, but let me just cut to the chase. Tom has a new podcast called Toy Heart. Like I said, it's produced by the Bluegrass Situation, and he is going and sitting down with bluegrass legends and having some of the most insightful and in-depth interviews I've heard from some of these players ever. He's talked to Bela Fleck, he talked to Del McCurry, he talked to Ricky Skaggs and Alice Gerard, and there are a bunch more on the way. And though they normally don't have the gear focus that maybe we do when we sit down and nerd out with some of these kinds of personalities, Tom is such a talented interviewer. He's able to get amazing stories that you just wouldn't hear about anywhere else. Who knew? Bela Fleck's kid is a golfer? I had no idea. That was one of the many gems from the recent Bela Fleck interview that I picked up. His son is taking up the sport of golf because he watched it on TV for the very first time with his grandfather. So all sorts of cool moments like that. Again, the podcast is called Toy Heart. It's done by Tom Power, this week's guest. And unlike this podcast and unlike a lot of them, it doesn't come out every week or every day. So if you feel inundated and swamped in your podcast routine, I think it'll fit in nicely. It's like 90 minutes every couple of weeks. Before we get to that, as always, we have a couple of announcements. Our FJ Fest, our virtual stay-at-home guitar festival taking place right now, is continuing to unveil all sorts of surprises. Rachel Rosencrantz, a luthier over in Rhode Island, just talked to us about the ukulele she's making out of a mushroom. We've had in-depth tours of TJ Thompson's shop, and we're going to post a Megan Wells video tomorrow. Basically, we're letting luthiers and guitar makers and music collectors grab the iPhone and give us a little tour of what's going on and what's going on behind the scenes. It's always fun to see how the sausage gets made. And I've been doing this magazine a long time, and I am learning so much. It is just cool to get in the mind of some of these craftspeople. Only thing else I want to mention before we get to our interview with Tom is, of course, we have a couple of sponsors for this podcast. First up is our friends over at Mono, monocreators.com. You can see their entire line of gig bags, laptop bags, pedal boards, you name it. If you have a Dreadnought guitar, you probably want to check out the Mono Classic. It is a great gig bag. And I also want to say, since so many of us are staying at home and not gigging, they also have really cool, elegant, modern, and and pretty foolproof studio monitor stands. So if you are building out your music room, check out what Mono is offering. It'll beat the cinder block that you were contemplating. Our other sponsor, of course, is our friends over in New York at Retrofret Vintage Guitars. I've said it a million times, and I'll say it a million times more. This is one of my favorite stores in the entire world. The inventory that they get, the instruments that they have are all so interesting. I encourage you to go to retrofret.com and check them out. You cannot go to their store if you are in New York right now. It's locked up like so many other stores, but they are still getting new instruments and old instruments and updating their inventory almost every single day and still selling and shipping guitars on a daily basis. They have a 1947 Marden 00021 that looks incredible. They have a guitar that I actually own. It's not the exact same guitar, but I have a 36 Gibson L00 that I play more than any other acoustic guitar in my small collection. You should check that out. And of course, since we're talking bluegrass with Tom, I figured I'd look up a couple of bluegrass instruments that they have. They have a 1938 Gibson F5. This is obviously the model that Lloyd Loar engineered and that Bill Monroe made famous, but a 30s model, late 30s model. So it's got the big inlays, all the tone that you would ever want, but a little more bling. They also have an instrument that I guess we can call vintage now, a 1984. So that's 36 years old already. Kentucky KM1500. This is the mandolin equivalent of the lawsuit guitar. This was the first wave of Japanese instruments that showed a lot of American manufacturers that if you really wanted to recreate something from the past, you could. That looks like a tremendous instrument. Either of those mandolins will be welcomed into any bluegrass jam, provided you know how to play. All right, that is all I have for you right now. Again, go to fretboardjournal.com if you want to see all that FJ Fest coverage or subscribe. We, of course, have a couple other podcasts beyond this one, but right now, let's just focus on what Tom is up to. His podcast is called Toy Heart. It is brought to you all by The Bluegrass Situation. And I encourage everyone, if you've listened to this podcast, you definitely need to check out what he has been up to. It is a lot of fun. All right, here's our conversation. Well, Tom, thanks for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast. I have so many questions for you about Toy Heart, the podcast that you just launched a few months ago. But before we get to that, for all the folks listening maybe south of the border here in the States, can you give us a little description of who you are and what your normal day job is?
Oh, yeah. So my name's Tom. I'm from St. John's, Newfoundland, which is an island off the east coast of Canada. We were the last province to join Canada. So we didn't join until 1949. So my parents were born Newfoundlanders. I was part of the first wave of Canadians to be born, which is kind of crazy to say, you know. I'm not going to say I'm a first generation Canadian because I'm not, but I'm from a pretty interesting little place and a place that didn't have a whole lot of bluegrass and folk music. And we can talk a little bit about that. But my day job is I host Q on CBC Radio and on NPR in the States. And every day I'm lucky enough to talk to artists and musicians and, you know, and painters about their art and why it matters and, you know, a little bit about them and talk to them about their lives. And in addition to that, I play in a band called the Dardanelles, which plays traditional music from my home. And I play guitar in Irish music sessions. And yeah, and if I didn't have a whole lot of free time, and I said, why not fill it up with a bluegrass podcast?
So, which begs the question, I know a little bit about St. John's, and they do have a music scene, but not necessarily bluegrass from what I know. I know icebergs come in from, Greenland? Am I getting this right? Into the harbor?
We have a lot of icebergs off the, we have a lot. It's part of our all right. Charm is all the
colorful buildings, the icebergs. I don't know about too many banjos or bluegrass instruments. So how did your infatuation with bluegrass start?
So Newfoundland has a great I think it's, you know, it's been written up as one of the greatest places to hear folk and roots music in the world, in that it has a pretty distinct culture of traditional music. Like, there is Newfoundland fiddle music, which is, you know, largely the folks who are on their way to the U.S. to start music that will become bluegrass music and country music. You know, if they couldn't, I like to say if they got a bit seasick and they had to get off the boat, they stopped in Newfoundland, you know. But there was, you know, Scotch and not so much Scottish, but Irish and English musicians were there, as well as Portuguese and French musicians. So there's this beautiful tradition of music from Newfoundland that sounds a lot like Irish and French and Portuguese music. And that was all kind of, it was all kind of pushed on us pretty young. Like, you know, that was a part of our identity. And I kind of rejected it a little bit. We sang a lot of those songs around the house, and we sang, you know, old Newfoundland songs, and I liked them, but whatever. And then, like so many people my age, it was Oh Brother.
Wow.
Okay. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou was the thing that grabbed me. You know, I heard my brother, I was listening to Guns N' Roses and Korn and Limp Bizkit, mm-hmm. and my brother brought home Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the soundtrack. And I knew, like, there was a banjo in my house. There was a little tenor banjo in my house that my dad had. And there was a lot of acoustic guitars in my house because my dad was a folk musician when in his younger years. And we were a big sing-along family. But I heard that music and it really spoke to me. You know, I've got to speak to a lot of musicians who feel the same way. You know, I used to think it was a bit of an odd thing. But, you know, I spoke to the folks in Mumford & Sons and they said the same thing, that Oh Brother was sort of this awakening for them, you know. And then I got into the music, but there wasn't a whole lot, as you mentioned, of that kind of music kicking around. There was a lot of folk music, but there wasn't a lot of bluegrass. And I went hunting around for banjo lessons. I couldn't find them anywhere, but I knew I loved the sound of the banjo, and I convinced my mom to get me one for Christmas. And I brought it home and I played it with a flat pick because I had no idea how it was supposed to be played. I didn't know people were playing it with finger picks. Sure. I just played it with a flat pick, you know, the best I could. So we were hunting around for banjo lessons. I put together, like we all do, a bit of a band, and I got up and played like some kind of weird facsimile of bluegrass, kind of teaching my friends how I thought it should go. And a guy came up to me and he said, listen, I play banjo. I'd love to teach you. You seem to have a real enthusiasm for this music. And this is where it gets a little crazy. That guy, there are three banjo players, five string banjo players in Newfoundland, including me. One is a guy named Dave Lush, who's a great banjo player. He's in a band called the Masterless Men. And the other guy is Neil Rosenberg, who is the preeminent scholar on bluegrass music, managed Bean Blossom, Bill Monroe's camp there, and his, you know, his kind of like home festival there, played in the Bluegrass Boys, has a Bluegrass Boy belt buckle, and is considered to be, yeah, the greatest scholar of bluegrass music of our time. Wrote the first academic article about bluegrass music becoming a named music. He just happened to be there. And he invited me over to his house every Saturday morning, and I'd go over there with my banjo, and we'd sit there for an hour. And I'd say about 15 minutes of that hour was spent actually learning how to play the banjo. And then 45 minutes was just me wanting to know more. Who was Sonny Osborne? Who was Bobby Osborne? Who are these people? Who's Lester Flatt? And I think being able to sit with a folklorist like that taught me that the why of the music is as important, if not more important sometimes, than the what of the music. I became infatuated with the stories behind this music and the larger stories they told about society and America and country music and all these strange characters that seemed so exotic to me. And I ended up studying folklore and because of Neil, and I ended up doing interviewing because I wanted to study more folk musicians and I wanted to study music the way that he had studied bluegrass. Found my way into interviewing, got half decent at it, and that's how I got my job on public radio, kind of like doing a Canadian fresh air. I like to call myself a taller, portlier, far less talented Terry Gross. And I found myself in that situation because of bluegrass. But it was strange. Like, you know, it was a music that I was essentially by myself, completely, deeply in love with. And I was fortunate enough that, you know, Napster and all that stuff came around at the same time. I think I could admit this now without the cops coming to my door, that I would find, like, you know, Bear Family box sets, and I would find King Stanley Brothers back box sets and Jimmy Martin box sets and just go through them with a fine tooth comb. You know, it really grabbed me. And everyone I've talked to in this podcast sort of has a similar story, that it grabbed them and they didn't know why, but it really did.
Wow. And Neil did he just retire there? It's such an unlikely place for him to end up.
Yeah, well, he was a professor. I mean, he's still with us. He's a professor of folklore at Memorial University. You know, he was studying bluegrass music in the States. He was also studying parrot jokes, like jokes that are told by parrots.
Of course.
And then you know, jobs for folklore professors, you know, they come when they come. And he got hired to come, as far as I know, to come to Memorial University to help build the folk language archive there, like to help, because we have this really distinct folk culture there, to help build an archive. And he ended up getting a job and getting tenure and falling in love with Newfoundland and staying there. But there's really no logical explanation for how that worked out. That, you know, the preeminent, you know, scholar of bluegrass music happened to be a 5-minute drive from me my whole life, and I had no way of knowing. And I'm eternally grateful for it. It changed the course of my life.
Did immersing yourself with all this knowledge Neil gave you, did it also translate to you wanting to play out more and forming a bluegrass band, or was it more academic for you at that point?
I mean, a bit of both. I definitely had a bluegrass band when I was in high school, and I was in a band, and we played, you know, Bill Monroe and Stanley Brothers and Flat and Scruggs and kind of standards and Bela Fleck stuff too, like anything I could kind of get my hands on. And I had some good friends who were interested in the music, and we would kind of share recordings with one another, and I'd come in and teach them, like rank strangers to me, and we were pretty good. You know, we played folk festivals and we played bluegrass festivals. But when I was around 18 or 19, I discovered... my brother-in-law said to me, "Hey, I know you're really interested in all this like folk music. Do you know that we have something pretty special here?" And I had never really paid any attention to it. And then I became sort of equally obsessed with Newfoundland music, the music of my home. And I went out and actually did a lot of the collecting and did a lot of recording and started a band with my friends, the Dardanelles, and playing kind of like our version of Newfoundland music. And we did really well, you know. We continued to have a new record coming out soon. But, you know, we started touring the world doing festivals. And it was kind of cool for me because we'd play these festivals and we'd be on the same ones as the McCurries, or we'd be on the same ones as Ricky Skaggs. And it was exciting to me. But the academic part was always with me, especially when I was in university, because our school had an amazing folklore, especially bluegrass periodical section, which made no sense except that Neil taught there. And I guess he was formative in putting together the library. There's no reason for a rock in the middle of the North Atlantic to have like every issue of Bluegrass Unlimited ever, but it did. So I would go in under the guise of like doing my psychology homework or doing my biology homework. And instead I would just read folklore, bluegrass periodicals, every book I could possibly get. And, you know, but then that it kind of left me for a while. You know, I started focusing more on Newfoundland music. I started touring more. I started doing other kinds of work. And I would listen to bluegrass a little bit at home. And I would kind of buy a Bill Monroe book if it came out. But when it came time to do Toy Heart, I realized that I had a lot of this knowledge from spending sort of like a Malcolm Gladwellian 10,000 hours on it from the time I was 15 until I was like 22. So a little bit of both. But I have to say that I have friends who play bluegrass pretty professionally in the States. No, I cannot play bluegrass. I can play enough that I can hang out a little bit and I can sing a bunch of songs, but man, oh man, like, I don't know. I also got into John Hartford and that kind of changed my banjo playing entirely. So, you know,
yes.
I still play every now and then, just kind of for fun.
Yeah. And are you dabbling? You do guitar and banjo now?
So my main gig is I'm a backing guitar player. I know you guys have worked with the great John Doyle a lot, a great Irish guitar backer. I play kind of like him. So my gig is I play, you know, Irish music. I back up fiddle players. I back up banjo players. I'm pretty good at, you know, figuring out chord changes and doing chord substitutions and stuff like that. So I play Irish sessions and I tour a little bit playing guitar. The banjo is mainly at home, though sometimes on my radio show, I'll bring it out. Like we had Bela Fleck on and I got the banjo out and we did a duet together.
Nice.
And, you know, that was a bit of a trip, man. I never really will ever forget that. And on cue, we had... You know, Celine Dion challenged me to do a banjo version of one of her songs, so I did that. So, you know, every now and then, and if someone needs it for a recording, sometimes I'll come in, or more likely I'll just offer the gig to a far better banjo player than me.
So before we get to Toy Heart, I got to ask, how does a young guy, get a radio show in St. John's, and the next thing you know, you're interviewing Celine Dion? What was the original pitch for the radio show, and how did you get your feet wet?
I was telling someone this story. Our co-producer on the show, a great old-time fiddler, Stephanie Coleman, she and I were talking about it. She kind of asked me this the other night, and I don't really know, except that the short story, and if you can tell already, Jason, I don't offer many short stories.
It's all good. But perfect interview.
The short story version of this is that I was singing unaccompanied ballads. I mean, it's a typical journalism story, isn't it? You get discovered singing unaccompanied ballads.
Still how Walter Cronkite got into it. Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. I think he was there. I think Peter Jennings was just singing Barbara Allen and they picked him up. I was singing at an unaccompanied song session that happens in Newfoundland at the end of every month. And there happened to be a CBC producer there who I think thought it was interesting that, you know, a kid was kind of doing this. And I had a campus radio show where I played folk music and bluegrass music. And I was also doing radio on the weekends. I had a little gig at a, you know, minimum wage gig at a private radio station reading the weather. And he asked me a couple of questions about myself. And he said, you know what, if you ever have an idea, send it over. And I went to the library. I ignored all of my work again. I was a really poor student and focused on putting together this pitch for a folk music show, because that year the Ducks, who are a great Canadian folk band, they were signed to Sugar Hill and you know, a great, they did really well in the US as well. They had been nominated for a Grammy and no one had talked about it. So I said, well, you know, there needs to be someone talking about folk music on the CBC. I mean, I was 21. I was 20. I mean, it was incredibly brazen, but it was that naivety of youth. I put it in the pitch. It just so happened that the entire format of the national public broadcaster was changing from an all classical format to a more varied musical format. They had no idea how young I was, and they took the show. So there I was at 21 on my 21st birthday. I was hired by CBC to be a folk music guest disc jockey. And I hate saying this, but people bring it up a lot. It made me the youngest national host in CBC history. And I did that for a few years. And then the morning show, the kind we have, as opposed to like NPR, where it's very regional, our shows are largely national. So the national morning show host quit, and I got asked if I wanted to fill in, and I said no a bunch of times, and I eventually said yes. And I moved to Toronto and started waking up at 4 a.m. playing music. And then the host of the show I currently host got fired in a very, you know, public sex scandal, kind of an early Me Too.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, Gian Gomeshi, a very early Me Too scandal. And then there was another host after that. And then eventually they came to me and asked if I'd be willing to do it, because I'd kind of proven myself. I'd been able to get younger listeners interested in music that they didn't think younger listeners would be interested in. And then next thing you know, I'm hosting Q, and that show affords me the privilege of getting to talk to really amazing musicians. And in addition to talking to your like Celine Dion's and your George Clooney's and your, you know, your Emma Stone's, your Ringo Starr's, I've also snuck a lot of bluegrass on there, you know, like I brought in Rhiannon Giddens and I brought in Molly Tuttle, you know, I brought in Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn. You know, not necessarily people who, you know, would have maybe been on these shows in the old days, but I'm kind of bringing them to the Canadian public. And it's been really nice to do that, you know.
That's awesome. That's amazing. So how did Toy Heart come about? How did the podcast on bluegrass happen?
So I had been toying with this idea for a long time, because I love the I don't want to say the art because it sounds so pretentious, but I love sort of the craft of what I do. Like I can tell you do too, you know, like I can tell you love, you know, knowing people and meeting them, and I can tell you're curious about them. And I really loved that, you know, but to be honest, you know, like I think the reason Q became successful is because I didn't have a great knowledge of film. I didn't have a great knowledge of ballet. I didn't have a great knowledge of visual art or jazz. So I could just ask questions. I had to learn how to ask questions and be interested in them. But I began to wonder, like, what would happen if I took these things that I had been learning how to do on Q half decently and applied them to the stuff that I loved the most, the music that like changed my life, the music that I kind of cared the most about. And I started to look around and I saw, I mean, now there's a couple more, but at the time there just wasn't a whole lot of exploration of bluegrass musicians. And I started to see that they were starting to die. I mean, Mack Wiseman died, Earl Scruggs died without someone sitting down with him for an hour and a half to, you know, to get the story. Bill Monroe, for God's sake, you know? So it had always been sort of in the back of my mind. And I also saw it as a way to continue the work done by people like Neil Rosenberg and Pete Kuykendall, like these people who had done such great work in the early 1970s of documenting, or 70s and 80s of documenting this music. And I was at Folk Alliance. I was at a, you know, a great conference there, and I was talking to a friend of mine, and I said, you know, I had this idea, and they said, you know, my friend works for the Bluegrass Situation. I think she's here. It was in Montreal. Why don't I put you guys in contact? And she knew my radio show because Q airs in Nashville, and in Los Angeles, where she lives. And we had a coffee, and I pitched her my idea, and she said, yeah, let's just do it. It was just like that.
Nice.
And next thing you know, Amy right now with Jacobs, she just started emailing people and getting people to agree to interviews. And I flew to Nashville for a summer, and I would just drive out to meet these people and sit down and talk to them. And it was, Jason, was so nerve-wracking.
I can only imagine.
Because you know what I mean? These people didn't exist. These were Bill Monroe, sorry, not Bill Monroe, I'd love to talk to him, but like Del McCurry and Ricky, like these guys are, or you know, Alison Brown, they are characters in books that I've been reading. They might as well have been like Lancelot or Poirot. And then to sit down and actually talk to them, it kind of blew my mind. But once the nerves subsided, I guess we managed to get somewhere.
Yeah, you did. I was going to ask you, so these were all done in person, it sounds like. How are you formatting it? How are you structuring? What is it? How many episodes in a season?
8 episodes in a season. The format is that I wanted to start, I didn't want to be grim about it, but I kind of wanted to see if I could get the whole story from birth to now. It means I got to skip some parts somewhere along the way. And sometimes for time sensitive spaces, you know what it's like, you got to skip, you know, a bunch of stuff, but you know, I kind of wanted to start with, all right, where were you born? You know, where did you, I used to listen a lot to Mark Maron, the WTF podcast. Sure. And I really liked that format where, you know, he would talk to Ted Danson and say, okay, so where are you from? And he would end it with, okay, so what are you working on now?
Yeah.
And I thought someone needs to do that to bluegrass musicians, that like
linear,
there's a world. And yeah, that we could just start with, okay, so Del, where are you from? And then by asking little questions just along the way, and just kind of the questions didn't need to be any more than, okay, so then what happened? I could really get a story and maybe get some stories that they hadn't told. And maybe a couple of things. Maybe I thought that like maybe by being an outsider geographically and culturally to this music, I would be sort of like able to ask questions that maybe insiders might be a little bit afraid to ask. And also by someone who knows a lot about this music, they didn't have to give me their like, here's what a banjo is answer. So I thought we were sort of like, yeah, I had to say, but I didn't realize until I actually sat down in front of them that I had to sit down in front of them. But everyone was very kind. And I think everyone was really giving about getting the music out there and kind of telling their story.
Yeah. Yeah. First off, note to any music fans out there, when you're going to meet your music hero, don't approach them with the, what string gauges question are you using? You know, like that's just the biggest conversation killer ever. Try to actually have an arc to your fandom, which you clearly do. So can you tell, I know Alice Gerard's up, I listened to the Del McCurry one, you got Ricky Skaggs. Are you willing to spill the beans on some of the other first 8 guests?
So we have Bela Fleck, Alice Gerard, Ricky Skaggs, Del McCurry. Then we're going to have Alison Brown, Tony Trischka, Jerry Douglas.
Always fun,
And Jesse McReynolds.
Okay.
And not to be grim again, but Jesse McReynolds was meaningful to me because I always felt like Jim and Jesse and the Virginia Boys were kind of under-examined in terms of the first groups of bluegrass. You know, when people talk about the first groups of bluegrass, there's like the Stanley Brothers, you know, Bill Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys, Don Reno and Red Smiley, Flat and Scruggs, and Jim and Jesse. And it's always and Jim and Jesse. Mm-hmm. Jesse McReynolds is in some ways like the last link we have to the incredibly formative. Like he remembers playing music and they're not being bluegrass. You know, his grandfather was at the Bristol Sessions, like the birthplace of recorded country music. It was so cool. He's like 90 years old. It was amazing to sit down and talk with him. And I really felt like the mission was there, which was to kind of get these, not to be grim, but I know I don't mean to make Jesse feel weird, but like to get these stories before we can't get these stories anymore, you know?
Of course. I mean, that's kind of why the Fretboard Journal, you know, exists as well. And then after 7 or 8 issues and everyone was like, this is a magazine for geezers, I had to bring some young people into it. But that was the original inspiration for sure.
I know. I mean, I was happy to talk. And then like eventually it became more about telling the story of how this music changed and who changed it. And that's how people like Bela and Tony and Ricky came into the conversation, you know. I think it's been really interesting to me. I tell you, one of my favorite things about it is just like realizing how punk rock bluegrass is. I heard this, you know, people, Jesse McReynolds told me a story about like him and Jim in the early days. Like, I have friends who play in punk bands. I have friends who play, like, you know, house shows, and they sleep on couches in people's basements, you know, if they're lucky, and they think they're super DIY. And then Jim and Jesse would drive around to communities with, like, just asking if they had a schoolhouse. Do you guys have a schoolhouse? Yeah, I think we got a schoolhouse. All right, where is it? And they would just break into it somehow, go into the schoolhouse, set up on stage, and start passing out, you know, flyers saying, "Hey, Jim and Jesse here tonight, country music concert." People are like, "Oh, okay." They went in to see the show. Jesse would take the car battery out of their car, plunk it on the stage, plug the stereo system they had brought with them into the car battery so it would give it some electricity, and then perform a concert. Like, if that's not the most DIY thing, it makes every single other punk band in the world look like the Rolling Stones. Like, bluegrass is the ultimate DIY music in those early days. And I think they don't talk about it enough because, I don't know, maybe I'm getting too honest here, but like, maybe sometimes they can be a bit embarrassed of it. But to me, it's like the most formative punk version of country music. And to hear what they actually went through is unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the beauty of what you're doing and what really enthralled me and made me want to do this interview is bluegrass, and I know a lot of bluegrass musicians, including some super well-known ones, it's a little intimidating. You know, there's a polish. You're dealing with old songs that not everyone in your community may necessarily know, but in some communities, everyone knows. And then there's just this austerity and polish that so many bluegrass, as well as the traditionalism. And, you know, you've got Del McCurry spinning stories about trying to get out of the army. You have Alice Gerard talking about how Bill Monroe pulled up his bus and would just party at her house, which is just insane. Like, these are real people, and they were cool, and they are cool, you know?
Yeah. It's a genre of music that's really given to mythology. I remember I had Rhiannon Giddens on one time, and I asked her a question on cue, and I asked her a question about the history of the banjo. And I said, well, you know, of course the banjo is an African instrument that was brought to North America. And she said, you know, Tom, like, it's actually more interesting even than that. Like, there's a narrative that it was, you know, this instrument, and there's a narrative that there's this other instrument, and it takes a little bit more research and a little bit more work. But if you actually find the truth of this music, of country and blues and bluegrass music, it's actually way more interesting than the narratives that were presented. And that always really stuck with me, because I think that bluegrass music is, and I want to be clear, it's the music that I love the most, but it's prone to mythology, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Like, it's prone to, oh, and then like this was bestowed upon him, like sort of Lancelot thing. And I think we've all kind of bought into those myths because they're amazing. But I've always been of the opinion, and maybe this is my folklore background, that if you can get to the truth, not to say that the myths don't have value, but to get to the truth behind the myths is almost more interesting. So two of the interviews that I've done that I can think of, I wanted to address a couple of myths around them. One was, you know, that Ricky Skaggs was sort of, he always tells that story about how he was pulled on stage by Bill Monroe and handed the mandolin, sort of like bestowed upon him. And then he became, then he performed bluegrass music for Bill Monroe. And I always thought to myself, like, how much could you possibly remember? I don't remember anything from when I was 4 years old. Yeah. And I asked him, I said, listen, I know you've told the story a lot. What do you actually remember? And he said, not a lot. A lot of it is just what people have told me. And frankly, I've been looking for a picture of that pretty much my entire life. But I do remember a lot of bright lights. I do remember him pulling on my arm and pulling me up and it kind of hurting. And I always said that's why one of my arms was longer than the other. And I remember just everyone watching me. And that was so much more meaningful to me then. And then Mr. Monroe handed me the man, you know?
Sure.
I mean, same with Bela Fleck. He tells that story about how we watched the Beverly and it changed his life and he heard the banjo for the first time. And I said, what actually happened? What do you remember? And he said, I remember, like, he remembers what else was on TV and he remembers the carpet and he remembers telling his brother to shut up. And he remembers, you know, to me, the story of this music is far more interesting than the myth around it. And if nothing else, I can just get it down. Like, the nice thing about this podcast is that I just want to get it down. Yeah. And if I can just get people to actually say it, that's half the victory right there. I mean, you know all about that.
Yeah, that's the beauty. I mean, as a writer, editor of a print magazine, the beauty of the podcast is you do the interview and it's done. There's no more work. I mean, there's post-production work, but you've done what you could.
I just want to say, by the way, and I try to save this stuff. You said earlier, don't ask people about their string gauges. My other advice is don't unveil your fandom until you want to. I used to start interviews by going like, hey, I'm just a big fan. And that always put me in a weird, I don't know if you find, yeah, but it puts me in a sort of a weird situation. I tried to do it halfway through or like towards the end. Can I just say, big Fretboard Journal fan, and wanted to say it. I wanted to save it until now. Like, I didn't want to do it off the top because I didn't want to seem disingenuous by opening with like, by the way, huge fan. But as someone who likes this kind of music, I'm excited to be on it.
Oh, well, thank you. So where do you go from here? You've done 8 episodes that were all in Nashville. I know no one is traveling right now. Is your hope for the next season to go to a different city? Or, I mean, you could mine Nashville for five seasons, but what's your strategy?
Well, where do we go? I went to Nashville mainly. I also went to Durham, mm-hmm, North Carolina to talk to Alice Gerard, but Nashville was kind of my home base. The new season is an interesting time to ask me that question. I am trying to figure out when I can get out of Canada, and the answer is not that soon. The new season won't come out until the winter, probably January, February. Sure. So it gives me that amount of time to do it. But however, I have a sort of a wish list of people I want to talk to. Like, I want to see if I can get to Ben Eldridge to talk to him about the Seldom Scene, you know, about that particular scene of bluegrass around Virginia, around Washington, D.C., and talk about how that was a little pocket that changed bluegrass forever. I want to talk to Sam Bush about the Newgrass revival. You know, I had a really nice chat with Bela Fleck. Did you see the Newgrass, the Sam Bush documentary?
Yes, it's amazing.
Isn't it amazing? Have you ever seen a documentary where they talk about how it didn't work out like that before?
No, that's actually, yeah, that's a great point.
I've never seen a documentary where someone was willing to go like, hey, this is why Newgrass revival didn't work out. And there was no nice ending with it, but it turns out it did work out, you know. it kind of let it hang. And I found when I spoke to Bela as well, like, he was pretty honest about it. Like, he was pretty honest about, like, here are the lessons I learned from Newgrass revival. One was, he said Sam Bush should have called it Sam Bush and Newgrass Revival. That way he could have just kept on hiring people. That's why Bela Fleck called it Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. So I really want to talk to Sam Bush about, like, being this sort of divisive figure in the music. You know, there's famous, you know, Bill Monroe being asked about, I mean, it's apocryphal, but Bill Monroe being asked about Newgrass Revival and him saying it's no part of nothing, which was the working title for the podcast. I'm really interested to talk to him. Gloria Bell, Gloria Flickinger, she's still alive. She was a woman who played bluegrass with Jimmy Martin. I can't imagine for a second what that was like. And she's still with us, which I found out by talking to Alice Gerard. I'm trying to track her down now. And sort of my white whale is Tony Rice. In fact, have you talked to Tony Rice?
We have interviewed, actually, yesterday, the person who interviewed him for the 5th issue of the Fretboard Journal back in 2006 or 2007 passed away, Art Dudley, one of our great contributors. Yeah. I think we may have landed with that article one of the last long Tony Rice interviews that have existed. Tony's around.
I know it very well. I know that article.
Tony's around, and, you know, I see posts on Facebook from his wife all the time. I mean, as we get into issues 40 and up, things start to get a little more obscure because we want to have some uncovered ground. My big wish, now that we've spoken to Tony about his guitar, is to do an interview about the allure of the Accutron watch, which, you know, he is supposedly still fixing up and restoring these Bulova Accutron watches from the 70s, and has sprouted this entire mini community of bluegrass players like Kenny Smith and Wayne Henderson, who all also wear Accutron watches, these crazy battery-powered watches that have a little tuning fork inside of them.
I love that.
So I've reached out through a handful of different channels of folks who do still have contact with him. And Tony, I know you're not listening to this, but you have an open invite to either of our shows. But I mean, all you
one
can
of my
do
favorite
is
moments
wait.
Of our. One of my favorite moments of our podcast is, and this is on the Bale episode, and I think it's on the Jerry episode too, Jerry Douglas episode, is them giving me advice on how to reach Tony Rice.
Okay.
Like these guys, those guys at the end of the interviews on the record going like, here's what I think you do. You go to his house, you hang out in his driveway, you get a hotel in the town,
wow.
Every day drive to his house and just say, hey, I'm here if you want to come out. And just wait, he might come out. Like that's their advice. And they'll be like, I'll send him a text, but he hasn't texted me back in 6 months. You know,
it feels like
it feels like everybody in the podcast is rooting for me to get Tony Rice. I hope we can do it. My hope was that someone would at least tell him that these conversations are being, cause he's such a large figure there are so many figures in bluegrass music, but like there's a few that really stand out and mm-hmm. Tony Rice in terms of like really changing the music. And I'm really interested in where like MASH comes from, and I'm really interested in like how J.D. Crow and the New South. One thing that comes up a lot in the podcast is like how J.D. Crow and the New South's record with Tony and Ricky and Jerry and Bobby Sloan like changed the music forever. My hope is enough people someone might tell him that like, hey, they're talking about you a lot on this podcast.
Yeah.
And then he might go like, well, let me set the record straight. And that's sort of my hope. And Tony, I know you're not listening to this too, but if it happens, I'll be in your driveway. And, and then next thing you do, I'll ask you all about your watch for the Fretboard Journal.
There you go. Thank you. Yeah. Cover all of our bases. I love it. I mean, I hate to say this, and yeah, you can only bite off so much, but like, this should be a television show of you on the road, the Anthony Bourdain style, meeting all these figures. But it, as a podcast, it works just as great.
I think so too. I think what the reason I really liked the podcast, I don't think this could have happened until the podcast thing kind of happened, because I listen to, I don't know about you, man, but I mean, we're kind of doing it now, but like, I listen to like 3 hour podcasts, you know, like I listen to 3 hour interviews.
I did.
And I never would have,
yeah.
You know, it's, our editor, who's incredible, our co-producer, she like gets these things down to like to 90 minutes, but even that's a long time. And I think the joy of the thing we're able to do here is like, no, you don't got to give me a soundbite here. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Like, you don't have to give me a soundbite here. Tell me what really happened, Del. Hold on. And then that led him to that story you mentioned about him leaving the army, which is a really polite way of saying what actually happened, he essentially told us that he went like AWOL a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. It blew my mind. And even Ronnie and Rob, his sons, afterwards came up to me and they were like, we've never heard him tell that story before. Oh, I should say he didn't go to AWOL. He was in, I don't know what the American terminology is for it, but like he was in training or whatever it is, boot camp or whatever it is. And he left, but you know, I don't think we would have got that story if we had to do it in 20 minutes.
For sure. Yeah. And there is something, just relaxing about, you know, it's just a couple of microphones and a little Zoom recorder the size of a cigar box. Like the minute cameras come out, people act differently.
Yeah. I think, I mean, I don't know about you. I think the goal is for them to just forget that we're recording at all.
Yeah.
You know, like if I can get them to say the magic words of like, hey, you know, I wasn't like, I hate to say it, like this is maybe not something I should admit, but like when Ricky in the interview with him, he says to me, you know, I never told anybody this story before. And he tells the story of how Bill Monroe offered him a job. Hey, why wouldn't you tell that story every day to strangers? Like if I had that, Bill Monroe offered me a job, I'd tell a bank teller.
Yeah.
I'd tell someone who, you know, I think those moments are captured because, you've been talking for a half hour. I mean, I even feel it now. I mean, you're great. You're a great interviewer. You know, I feel very comfortable. And like, you tend to forget that the microphones are on. And if they trust that you're not going to, you know, do this in a, take advantage of them or, sure. You know, be exploitative of the fact that they're comfortable, you can really get some really beautiful stories from them.
Yeah, definitely. So we got to circle back. This is the Fretboard Journal to your life as a musician. What guitar, what banjo do you have? What's your gear situation?
I have a 1970 J50.
Okay.
That I play all the time. I just play a lot. It's typically for the kind of music that I play, like Irish music, like Irish backing. I'm sure you know, it's a lot of like modern built guitars, a lot of bourgeois guitars. It's a lot of Loudon. Is that
sure.
what it is?
Loudon.
Yeah, Loudon. And a lot of Tacks. Do you say Takamine?
I do say Takamine, but I'm not on that informal basis with them. So, yeah, I know what you mean.
I've heard people say Takamines too.
Oh, no, I don't ever say that, but I, okay. You know, why not?
I guess Takamine. Tax. I like Tax because it sounds cool.
Yeah.
But I love the kind of the warmth of this old J50 I got from my friend Greg Walsh. His father, the late Ray Walsh, was a great musician in Newfoundland, played the piano accordion. And it was one of those situations where, you know, he had one and it was under the bed and he gave it to me. But as I was saying to you before we turned the microphones on, I'm a bad vintage guitar owner because I play a lot. I don't hang it up. And Jason, I'm so sorry. I always forget to humidify it.
Oh, wow. And you're in Canada.
I consider my guitar to be like a subscription service as opposed to a purchase. You know what I mean? Like I bought it once and then I have to pay X amount of money a year just to have it.
Yeah.
Because I keep on forgetting to. And so I have that and I play that a lot. And my other guitar that I play the most is a great luthier out of Winnipeg, a guy named Jordan McConnell. I was talking about the Ducks a little bit earlier. Yeah. He was the guitar player in that band. Jordan makes some of the most beautiful guitars in the world right now. He's been making guitars for the folks in the Abbott Brothers. He's been making guitars for, you know, essentially every Irish and trad musician, young Irish and trad musician kind of worth their salt right now. Beautiful, beautiful guitars. I'm not much of a, the weird thing about me is that I have kind of nice instruments and I don't know an awful lot about them, but the wood that he uses is, now, I believe it's Wenge,
mm-hmm.
W-E-N-G-E. Do you know what I'm talking
yeah,
about there?
Yeah, for sure.
I'll send you a picture of it, actually.
Sure.
Because he actually put the guitar up on his website because I wanted nothing on it. Like, I didn't want any fret markings. I didn't want any... I kind of really like the Tony Rice fretboard, where he had, you know, it was kind of a blank fretboard. And then it was just kind of this minimalist style that I really, really loved. And I play that an awful lot with I use kind of a G bass string on the low E.
Okay.
So I can get a nice low rumble out of the whole thing.
And are you still playing banjo?
Yeah, I have a little Gibson, you know, a Gibson from about 10 years ago, okay. You know, that I play a fair bit five string, and I have a Gretsch tenor banjo that I've been playing an awful lot. But that's been sort of my, can I send you a chat while we're doing this?
I don't know. It might break the internet.
I think so.
Yeah.
Hold on. See, did you get that just then?
I did just get that. Yeah. Thanks.
So click on that. That's my guitar.
Okay. Nice.
That's the guitar that it's lovely. Hey.
Yeah.
And if you scroll down to the third image, you see on the back of the headstock, there's a, flag there. That's the flag of the Republic of Newfoundland, our flag before we were a country, before we were part of Canada.
That's cool.
It's a beautiful instrument. And I just got a little Gretsch tenor banjo. That's been sort of my pandemic, my pandemic, you know.
Everyone needs task. A project. You're no sourdough yeah, baking for you. It's tenor banjo.
No, I'm learning hornpipes and jigs and reels, like Irish music on the tenor banjo, because as much as I love being a backing musician, come on, you want to play the melody sometimes. And I have a couple of auto harps and I have a couple of dulcimers, but they're, you know, kind of dollar store things that I picked up along the way that I kind of just play for fun.
That sounds great.
Same with my Beaver Creek nylon string that I have here next to me right now, just for kind of banging around on.
Nice. Well, Tom, I don't know. We could talk for hours, but I just want to tell people that if you've enjoyed the Fretboard Journal podcast or you've listened to any of the stuff we've put out or enjoyed any of the bluegrass leaning articles that we've put out over the years, Toy Heart is an incredible companion. I wish it was part of our podcast family, but that's okay. That we love the bluegrass situation too. And and all these interviews have just been total revelations. I've loved hearing them all. So I want to thank you.
Oh man, thank you so much. I'm a big fan of the Fretboard Journal, and I hope I didn't talk too much. Oh. But I love yakking on. I feel like, you know, when I started doing this, I'll say this, is that when I started doing these interviews, one thing that came up over and over again was that there was a moment where they found their people. You know, I interviewed Alison Brown, and she talks about the moment she felt so lonely, and she felt like no one really, and she felt like a bit of a weirdo liking the music that she liked. And then she met Stuart Duncan, and then she was like, oh, you know, I'm not alone in this. You know, Bela has those kind of stories. You know, everybody I've spoken to, except for the people who invented it, have those kinds of stories. And, you know, one of the best things about this is spending time in Nashville. You know, Critter Eldridge, who I know you guys have profiled. I stayed at his house while I was doing this, him and Kristen, and they did the theme for Toy Heart. They actually perform Toy Heart by Bill Monroe, and he's become a very good friend. And, you know, just spending time with the bluegrass musicians and the Punch Brothers guys, well, Critter and the bluegrass musicians scene in Nashville, you know, at 32, I finally felt the way that Allison did and the way that Ricky did. I felt like I found my people through this music. And I think that ultimately, on a personal level, has been the most rewarding thing about making this podcast.
I love it. Well, folks, like I said, check it out, Toy Heart. It's in all the usual podcast places. And Tom, thank you so much. You have an open invite if you can ever get away from being on camera or on microphone. You have an open invite to be on the podcast or in the magazine or whatever you'd like.
I'll do anything you want. If you want to talk about guitars with someone with a couple of really nice ones who doesn't know anything about them, if you want to do a feature where someone comes and looks at my guitars and shakes me and tells me what I have,
oh, that would be fun. All the better. Let's do that. We'll send Mark Stutman up. We'll send him to you.
And he can just look at my J50 and go, you really, really need to take better care of this thing. But you had Daniel Romano on, right?
I love Daniel Romano.
He's one of my good buddies. And one of my, he's maybe my favorite Canadian musician. Like, I just love him so much.
I can't say enough about that guy. And when he came through Seattle, even though I know it's not in the wheelhouse of most Fretboard Journal, you know, readers or listeners, I insisted that, or I really wanted him to come. It was really important to me that he came and did a video for us and was on the podcast. And, I can't say enough. I think he's one of the most interesting creative guys around.
Oh, he's unbelievable. If nothing else, listen to our podcast for sure, but then immediately listen to Daniel Romano. Yeah. Anyway, he has a very like similar idea about instruments that they're meant for playing, you know?
Sure. Yeah, he does. But maybe this is our spinoff show of guitar intervention. We'll have Mark come knock on the door and he'll bring a humidifier and shake some sense into you.
Thank you. Someone needs to do it. Thanks for having me, man.
All right. Thanks, Tom.